Hello, everyone. I am Chenille Lafayette, and this is Interconnected, a new podcast and video series on YouTube exploring the hidden infrastructure behind our connected future. We're diving deep into the wiring to explore how and why powerful digital infrastructure is the backbone of today's most game-changing innovations. From agentic AI to quantum computing to autonomous vehicles, none of it works without the invisible systems running underneath. Interconnected is designed to become a go-to guide to the complexities of digital infrastructure and how today's megatrends are building the digital future for tomorrow. Now, today's episode, we're going to get to know each other a little bit better. Kyle and Glenn, I've met you before, but we haven't really formally chatted, and I'm looking forward to today's conversation. We're going to be unpacking some of the tech disruptions we're really excited about and we're obsessed with. So, Glenn, please tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Thanks, Chenille. My name is Glenn Deckhaser. I am a global principal technologist within our sales organization here at Equinix. I've been in the industry for about 35 years, focusing mostly on storage, data management, and data technologies, and other issues such as data privacy and governance. So I get to talk to customers and our product team and our marketing team, and I get to see what everybody is doing and contribute.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking forward to everything that you have to say. Before we get into that, Kyle, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself as well.
Yeah, thanks, Chenille. So I'm Kyle Hilgendorf. I got my start in a corporate enterprise data center for a Fortune 150, kind of cut my teeth there, touched a lot of servers and storage and networks, and early days with VMware and public cloud architecture. So I did that for about 10 years. And then I spent 11 years as an industry analyst at Gartner covering all things public cloud. I'm actually looking forward in this podcast to talking to these incredible thought leaders that are at the forefront of the intersection of these disruptive technologies with real outcomes in the world, whether it be within healthcare or manufacturing, right, or education, and really talk about the implications and how that all comes together.
Yeah.
Now, a little bit about me. I'm a solution strategy lead here at Equinix, and I'm especially passionate about smart infrastructure and sustainability. And just a quick little tidbit, I'm really interested in seeing how in the long term we can bring net zero energy buildings to Jamaica, where I'm from. But I'm so excited to jump in and talk about some of the disruptions. Kyle, I heard from a little birdie that agentic AI is something that you're truly interested in. Like, what is that? Tell us what that really means.
Yeah, I am spending a lot of my mental cycles looking at agentic AI, and it is definitely the phrase and the movement that a lot of technologists are paying attention to right now. So, you know, if let me maybe just describe it in its simplest fashion in case any watchers or listeners aren't quite sure. So I think most of us are pretty familiar with generative AI. So this would be, I would say, more basic and consumer assistive AI, where we provide a prompt as a human. And it's a very much like prompt and wait, a very reactive model. Agentic AI is kind of the era we're heading into now, where it's much more proactive. And we're seeing multiple AI agents starting to work together and autonomously without any human interaction. So these agents are starting to communicate to take on difficult or significantly complex tasks.
Complex tasks like what? Like in our day-to-day lives? Are you talking about like as you are working with clients? Like, give me an example of how we're sending these over now.
Yeah, so I think we're starting to see like steps towards this. I wouldn't say like maybe we've seen a perfect agentic AI implementation, but we're seeing a lot of it in customer service, where you as a consumer or a customer are having a problem with something and you're submitting that request, and on the back end, multiple different agents are kind of working together to triage and use multiple different data points together to try to resolve your situation. So it's not just like I need a password reset, which would be maybe the most simplistic situation, but I'm locked out of my account. And then there's several steps that have to be taken. I know we'll get into this in later episodes, but autonomous vehicles are kind of the epitome of like a very sophisticated agentic AI solution, where they're taking a look at a lot of different traffic, logistics, GPS, and routing solutions, like what Waymo is doing with autonomous vehicles. So it runs the spectrum. I think we'll get into maybe some of like the real business value of agentic AI, because a lot of the examples we're hearing are consumer oriented, but it's very, very fascinating. It brings a lot of uncertainty. It brings a lot of risk, ethical questions, technology complexities that have to be sorted out to do this. But I think it's like moving AI from cool and fun to probably generating business value.
Well, isn't the, like, we've seen a lot of videos lately. I saw a video of a robot doing laundry, right? I saw a video which I sent to my mom right away, and she's like, I need that. Go find that for me. That's definitely an example of agentic, right? Because that has to go back and forth and make decisions autonomously.
Yeah, I mean, so this is where I think it's a gradient of possibilities, right? I don't know enough about that specific robot. It's possible that everything that robot needs to learn is built within its own core context, but more than likely, it probably also then has to interact with maybe the smart washing machine, right? Or maybe a sensor in the bedroom that says the laundry basket's full, something along those lines. I don't know how sophisticated that could get, but we're definitely going to be in this very hybrid model. I think it's very hard to point at one thing and say, that's definitely generative AI. And you point at something else, say, that's definitely agentic AI. I think it's a blur and a mix of that, right? The biggest difference is moving from a single prompt and a single response to multiple autonomous decisions that leads to a more complex outcome.
That almost seems scary, right? Like, hey, I'm teaching a few different agents, right? I guess that's what we call them. These agents are working together, and I'm assuming that doesn't always run smoothly, right? I guess that's some of the risks of just leaving that up to AI to handle on its own. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's very uncertain. And when something is uncertain, then it's scary. And I think that also runs a gamut of levels of scariness. Like, it'd be completely different to say, well, I'm going to let an agentic AI system book me a vacation versus like diagnose my disease and provide a care package for that, like a set of pharmaceuticals and treatments and so forth. Like, those are really big, you know, ends of the spectrum for me personally. And I think we could probably chart things all across the spectrums. But right now, like, we have human checkpoints along the way to look at some of these things. And we've made massive strides in the last 20 or 30 years. A lot more in the healthcare industry is automated, you know, electronic messaging and health records and so forth. But like, if we pull it back to like super interesting business value,
like finance
or manufacturing, think about the manufacturer who has to source materials from all different types of suppliers. And just-in-time inventory has been something that's been around in factories for a very long time. And there's been a lot of logistics involved in that. Think about the automation and autonomy that could be brought to that, like inventory in their factories. When something is getting low, an agent goes out and asks a supplier to send more. The agent at the supplier says, we're running low on inventory. And the agent back at the manufacturer says, well, okay, great. Well, then I'm going to order from a different supplier. And there's that becomes a spider web of all of these different pieces and parts and the logistics and supply chain of where they sell their product to, and it talking to either retail shops or dealerships or whoever. Like, there's very little that's probably scary about that. It's just very exciting.
What I'm interested in is, are we even going to be able to do that, right? Like, I think about the infrastructure that we need to be able to back that up. Tell us a little bit more about what you're thinking about from that point of view, Kyle.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I mean, everything has to be, no pun intended, interconnected, right? But all of these agents are going to be created and hosted by different entities, different organizations, and very likely hosted on large cloud providers in different regions and geographic locations. So you start to think about this agent at provider A and that agent at provider B and the secure communication and global networking that has to happen. Will the internet be good enough for that? Or will we need to stand up programmatically secure private high-speed networks to do that? And across all of those connections, you've got security, identity, authorization. So you've got the whole, you know, security paradigm of that. You've got a variety of different data sets to analyze, you've got agents that might actually come to different conclusions. And so you have to have like a rank and order of what if agent A comes to conclusion A and agent B comes to conclusion B, and those are different. How does that interact? So you've kind of got a whole workflow and logic. And this needs to be dynamic, right? Because agents are going to, there will literally be like no agent for function X today, and tomorrow it will show up. Yeah. And so when other agents start to become aware that a new agent exists, like, is it trusted? Does it have a certificate? Is it, can it be, have a handshake of, I mean, it's very, very complex. There's a couple of emerging protocols out there, like model context protocol and agent to agent protocol. Starting to do a lot of research on that. Like, this is how secure communication will be stood up and handled between these agents, but it's very dynamic. So it's like, it's not as simple as stand up a web server and people come to the website. It's gonna be like stand up an agent and other agents will flood to it programmatically.
I don't know. Are we ready? Are you ready for all of these workflows? And I wouldn't say no human intervention, but very little into human intervention.
I don't think it's the question of being ready or not. We got to be ready. And I think, you know, I think that there's some good work being done around trying to get our hands around, you know, the governance and the sovereignty of that stuff. There's good work being done there. I think you're going to see a lot of care being taken to make sure that when systems are reaching out to each other, that they are who they say they are, that they have a reputation behind them. That's all built in to this stuff. So it's not just going to be a wild, wild west, right? There's going to be some order to it. And so it's going to be really cool when we get this stuff in production.
Glenn, you know what? I feel like this is a good segue into data sovereignty, which is something I believe you're really interested in. I know we touched on it a little bit, but like, let's hear your take on that.
Well, so many people are confused in this topic because it you know, there's data privacy, there's governance, there's sovereignty, there's locality, there's residency, there's custody. There's all these words that tend to confuse people as to, you know, what's really going on. And so sovereignty is really about the fact from a national sovereignty perspective that if the data that belongs, first of all, data always belongs to the person who it's about, right? So your data, your input into ChatGPT that you want to go and find about vitamins, and if you put any personal stuff in there, that's, you own the data, right? So you're always the data owner. But then what happens is that processor, that whether it's ChatGPT or someone else, right? They store that data in their systems, right? And that system could be in the same country you're in, or perhaps not. Now, sovereignty refers to the ability that, you know, that data is subject to the laws of the country that you live in, because you're the person who owns that data. If you're an American and someone stores that data out in the UK, the laws of the United States still apply, and the privacy laws of the United States still apply to that data, even if it's sitting in the UK, and vice versa, right? With the EU and any country that happens. So that's sovereignty. And so what you're hearing a lot now is, you know, you got a lot of countries that for, you know, many reasons, I won't get into the details now, are really getting concerned that the data that belongs to their citizens is not under the control of their laws. It kind of escapes. And once it's out, it's gone. So there's a move for many countries to start to create their own, what they're calling sovereign clouds. Right. Singapore, for instance, I believe South Korea.
And this, Glenn, is because most of the public clouds tend to be United States based. Is that right?
Right. So without getting too deep, deep into the geopolitics of the situation.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, but even so, even without anything going on, right, there's the fact that you are going to be putting your data in a service that is by nature connected back to, let's say, an HQ in the US, which may not have the same stringent privacy rules or governance rules that you have, say, the EU with GDPR and DORA, or in South Korea or Singapore or what have you. So sovereignty is something that most of these countries are starting to be very concerned about. Now, when you marry that with all the things that Kyle was talking about before, hey, we got a world coming up where we're going to have agents talking to each other autonomously, data flying
across
all over
the world.
The world, and, you know, on networks, and meanwhile we've got this, you know, kind of counterbalancing, you know, physics of sovereignty and governance, all the regulatory stuff that are going to be, in some cases for some countries, saying I don't want the data leaving my border, That's not always the case, but that's, you know, that's data locality, right? So this dynamic is going to really, I'm not going to say it's going to put a damper on AI, because I think, again, I think there's going to be a lot of the dynamic of ask forgiveness rather than permission in many cases.
Yeah, Glenn, I'm all really curious about that. What do you think wins out, like features and technology or a privacy law, right? Because like a lot of times you can't have both of them at the same time. Like, I need that service. Oh, it's only provided by a provider outside of my country.
Mm-hmm.
But yet my privacy law says it can't. So like, I feel like that's like a battle that's always being waged, and it has actually for a long time, the whole time I've been in the industry.
Well, how many times have we seen the EU fine someone lately?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they stopped doing it.
It doesn't mean they stopped doing it. Yeah.
Right. So,
right.
So you could look at recent history. Now, that doesn't mean that's going to continue. I mean, the fines can get a lot worse. The pain can get really bad. And also I think there's a new type of influence on companies, especially in Europe, from a social perspective. We see society, we see people, regular people in the street, making decisions based on this stuff now, on sovereignty specifically.
Give me an example. Like, where is this happening? Like,
well, I think there's a natural tendency for people to want to use services that are local to them, that are going to represent their values. That is definitely going to be happening in IT. And I believe that also is driving a lot of the sovereign cloud movement. Now, it's not easy. And I think a lot of what's being discovered now by these countries is it's not easy to build any kind of a hyperscale cloud yourself. It's very, very difficult.
Or lots of people would have done it by now. Yeah, like Glenn, I'm curious. I mean, I've covered this industry, the cloud industry, you know, for a decade. And I find it so incredibly difficult to keep track of all of the unique privacy laws in even just like the big 15 or 20 countries. And I'm thinking about multinational corporations that are in so many North and South American and European and Asia Pacific countries. Like, it is half the battle just keeping track of what they should and shouldn't do or can and can't do? And has there ever been any movements on making that easier?
Yeah. Well, not making it easier. In fact, I think what you'll find is you've got I did a graph using ChatGPT, ironically, and I asked it to give me every known regulation on data privacy, governance, sovereignty, right? Everyone you could think of at any level. And it was a hockey stick. It was starting in like 1980 something, and it goes like this, like straight up. And as you get closer to this year, it's almost a vertical line up of how many new regulations are coming up. And if you're a CIO, global CIO, you're dealing with the aggregate of these regulations. It's not like one replaces another. There's like, there's the EU, there's UK, there's Australia, Singapore, all over the place. And then you've got the state ones, right? So it's theater-wide, country-wide, statewide. And you're dealing with all these things, and you look at this graph, and it's just like, holy cow. So the answer to your question, though, that I've heard from some other folks, some people I trust in the industry on this topic, are you look at the most stringent ones that there are out there. It used to be that GDPR was the one that people focused on. That is no longer, according to my sources, by a long shot, the most stringent one. You have
really,
Singapore, South Korea, and some others. And even within the EU, you got like Italy and Germany, but supposedly South Korea is really, really tough. China's tough. And Singapore had the most stringent ones. So the idea is that follow those and it becomes it subsumes a lot of the other stuff, right? Because you can't, to your point, you can't like keep track of every single little one, but at some point you kind of do if you're operating in that country. So it's what you do and then how you report and how you provide transparency. It costs companies a ton of money to get this done.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is something that I wish that there would be some more globalization of this and agreement. Don't see it happening for a few years, but maybe we get lucky, right? Maybe the push toward agentic.
Maybe we need some AI agents to translate all of the privacy requirements.
Right.
Or maybe the reality of that is global businesses start clamoring government saying, hey, we need a global regulatory regime, a standard at least that we could all deal with, because it'll become impossible to do business around the world and create this agentic future that you were talking about, which it sounds like most people are okay with, right? The people, that's kind of the direction of the industry. So if that's where the money is going to be made, I would think there'll be a push to I don't want to say homogenize, but at least standardize on reporting techniques, right? On you know, on the different regulations around sovereignty. But we have some time for that.
And what does that infrastructure look like? Like, can we even support that global look at data sovereignty? Or,
well, I mean, sure. I mean, on the one hand, it's actually pretty simple because, you know, it's if you were able to keep your data in your country within, you know, within one set of laws, done, right? And so that's the move to sovereign clouds.
Yeah, and most of the public cloud providers already give you the opportunity as a customer to pick a geographic location there, and they've entered a lot of these countries, and to make configurations and checkboxes within the configuration to say this, you know, data volume shall not be replicated outside of this country. So you can definitely do that. The problem is you can also make a mistake, and that's where some of these fines come from and so forth.
Yeah, but even in the case where you, like, say you click all the right buttons in that provider to say I'm not going to replicate into this data to this other location, right? The fact is their network does connect to other locations, and if you're in another site, you can access that data if you have rights to do so. So I guess my point is that it's not as simple as that. That's the thing that people don't understand.
It's never that simple, right? They do give you the power, you know, to make those configurations and to block that communication and so forth. But I would agree with you, Glenn, the vast majority of people probably not going to that nth degree and making all of those configurations in all of the perfect ways.
Yeah. The best quote I heard on this topic that I heard so far is that you can't buy sovereignty in a box. Is that there's nothing you can buy to do this. Same with privacy, right? And government. You can't buy it. It's something you need to do.
You know, data sovereignty still applies to something I'm interested in, the creator economy. I'm a creator myself. So like I have my own personal perspective as well as like I'm seeing much larger creators out there. And I just wanted to give you like a quick understanding of like what is going on behind the scenes.
I would love to know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I consume a lot of golf YouTube content. And
right.
It's actually quite entertaining. And I know there's probably a ton that goes in behind the scenes on that, so enlighten us on it.
How long are your golf videos? Are they 20
well,
to 30 minutes
like if
long?
It's, it could be anything from like a 10-minute like tip video, but like the things I've been getting into more recently are like these YouTube golf guys that end up playing in these tournaments, and a lot of times those are an hour to an hour and a half. And I don't watch it in one setting, right? I might watch like 30 minutes before I go to bed on my iPad, right? So in terms of like quality, it's like you want it to be sharp.
So golf bores you to sleep is what you're saying, Kyle.
Yeah, well played there, Glenn. Well played, yeah.
I'm going to give you what it looks like to create a 10-second video, let's say 15-second video for me. I'm going ahead. I'm shooting probably like 30 minutes worth of videos to create a 15-second video. Think about that, right? 4K, editing it in a tool called DaVinci Pro. And then I'm running it through an AI tool because I realize, okay, well, you know, 4K and 8K content doesn't work well with Instagram. It doesn't work well with a TikTok. So I need to be able to compress that, but compress it in a way where it still keeps the quality of my video. People are not thinking about what's happening behind the scenes. But like when a 30-second video is now created in a minute rather than an hour, and we're able to pump this out, like that's going to change, right? You're talking about massive compute power and storage required. Am I wrong? How is our infrastructure even going to be able to support that?
Yeah, so the storage, talk about that first. There's a term called the data sphere. And there's reports out there about how big that's going to get. And they said that we were going to get to about 25 zettabytes by 2025 this year.
Zettabytes.
We passed that by a lot. I think they vastly underestimated it. And the dynamic you're talking about, which is, you know, AI is not going to be just creating data like it's going, like it just isn't going to stop. It's going to be a data output machine.
Right.
So, and the storage is going to, storage is a huge problem. I mean, so the storage manufacturers are responding to this. Solidigm just came out with a 122 terabyte flash drive. 122 terabytes. Think about it.
Wow.
One flash drive.
One drive.
Innovation is always remarkable. Like, you know, every time we think we're about at the limits, some new disruption comes through to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're going to need that. And that's going to be for like the live stuff, like the AI stuff. But then you're going to have like the archive is even, you know, LTO 10. We're still talking about tape. By the way, it is 2025. And I just did say the word tape. It matters. It's still in vast use. You just don't see it because it's all in, you know, the cloud providers, their Glacier and the cold archive. That's all still, tape is still very, very in play here.
And the industry will find a way to either make the technological breakthrough or to charge to such a point to monetize the expansion of the infrastructure needed. And I don't know this industry that well, but I think creators will self-select into the amount of content, right, or the size of content based on how much it's costing them to create or how much they're monetizing and getting back for it. So it's kind of a cycle of, if I can create content that people will pay for, I get ad revenue and it brings in a certain amount of revenue, and I can pay a streaming service that revenue that I'm getting to get into a bigger tier. Like, it will, that's how the economy works. And if you don't, then you'll self-select out of that. Right. And I think it will somewhat stay in check.
Right. I'm pretty sure these platforms are, they're leveraging like, you know, Akamai and Cloudflare and their internal networks. But do they have the infrastructure that's going to ensure that the content can load quickly and reliably, and so that, you know, everyone is winning? It's not just the brands. It's not just the creators, but also the platform itself. Like, everyone has a stake at this point in time. And I think it's a lot of this is going to depend on the tools that we're using, as well as the platforms that we're using to share as well.
Yeah, I think the good news is the companies that you mentioned, the one thing they do well is scale. They have no choice but to keep up. So, you know, to keep doubling bandwidth as you keep going, you got new network technologies that are going to let the packets flow, you know, increase the number of lanes on that highway. You know, it's going to keep doubling and keep doubling. So I think the infrastructure is going to keep up as long as there's profit in it, right?
Right. Thanks so much for engaging me in this conversation. I'm so glad I got to bring you into my creator world, but I feel like there's still so much to look forward to based on all of the things that we spoke about. So whether you're building the future, strategizing around it, or just want to understand what makes it all tick, you're in the right place, rest assured. Because this isn't just about tech, it's about building a smarter, faster, more resilient world together. Follow the journey and join the conversation. Subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Interconnected, brought to you by Equinix.